Xia Guoman, the laywoman whose fear of bhikshus had been overcome by her visits to Guanyin Cave, had lost track of the master when he left the cave. As months turned into years, she would often ask people if they knew of the master or his whereabouts, but the answers were always vague or misleading, and although she did not cease her search, it continued to be fruitless. One day she broke her hand and went to see a doctor. The doctor prescribed dragon bones, to which Guoman replied, "I'm a vegetarian. I can't eat that." At that moment, another patient, Yi Guobai, a disciple of the master, overheard Guoman and asked her if she had a teacher. "No," replied Guoman. "But I know that there used to be a teacher of great virtue living in Guanyin Cave. However, I can't find him now." "What did he look like?" asked Guobai. "He had a long series of scars that went around his neck and descended across his chest, which had been burned into his flesh by flaming recitation beads fashioned of incense," said Guoman. "That's my teacher," said Guobai. Guoman set out with her the next day to see the master. Soon she became a disciple, and it was not long before the rest of her family also took refuge with the Triple Jewel. After they took refuge, the hardships they had encountered upon first coming to Hong Kong vanished, and the family prospered. Guoman was overjoyed at finding the master again after such a long separation, and she frequently made the long climb up to Western Bliss Gardens, where she would bow to the Buddhas and recite the name of Amitabha Buddha in the peaceful surroundings. One day, when she glanced out the temple window, she saw to her horror that the peach trees outside were alive with caterpillars, thousands of them, squirming, wriggling, and falling off onto the surrounding shrubs and paths. There must have been 5 or 6 caterpillars on every leaf of the trees. They were not ordinary caterpillars, but a kind which inflict a sharp, painful sting and infection when touched. If there was anything that frightened Guoman more than bhikshus once had, it was caterpillars. The sight of them left her terror-stricken, and she didn't dare venture outside the door for the rest of the day. That evening, when the day's cultivation was over, she said to the master, "Sirfu, I certainly want to come back tomorrow, but the whole garden is full of caterpillars and they scare me to death. I can't possibly return in the morning." "Don't worry," said the master, "and don't be afraid to come tomorrow. When you get here, there won't be any caterpillars." The next day, Guoman climbed the mountain with trepidation, but with enough faith to get her to Western Bliss Gardens. When she arrived, she didn't see a single caterpillar, although the day before there had been thousands crawling all over the trees, the paths, and the ground. Every last one had vanished. The master had ordered them to move out. How was he able to do that? The caterpillars were, in fact, transformations of the 10 dragons who had taken refuge with the master at Dragon Rain Cottage in Manchuria years before. Together with their retinues of dragons, they had subsequently acquired, as they went about living up to their names, quickly cultivate and hurry up and save. At Western Bliss Gardens in the spring of 1955, the master lectured the Universal Door chapter of the Lotus Sutra, causing those who heard to gain new understanding. on the last day of the lecture series, when the master was expounding the Dharma from the high seat, a small duck popped through the fence and waddled across the garden to the door of the temple. Without hesitation, it stepped inside the great hall, selected a spot in front of the master's seat, puffed out its feathers, and settled on the floor. It sat silent and attentive, looking exactly as if he had come to listen to the sutra lecture. Whose duck was it? Or where had it come from? No one knew. Someone in the assembly got up and shooed it out, but it soon returned and settled down to listen once more. Again, someone tried to scare it away, but it soon returned to the hall. Several more times people sent it scurrying, but each time the duck would come waddling back into the hall. Finally, the master told everyone to leave the duck alone, and to everyone's surprise, he proceeded to administer the three refuges to it. Strange as it may seem, after the master finished speaking the precepts, the duck got up, waddled hesitantly over to one of the kneeling mats, dropped to the ground, and bowed its head. When the master finished the lecture and descended from the high seat, the duck promptly left the assembly. To celebrate the anniversary of Amitabha Buddha's birth, a Buddha recitation session was convened for 7 days at Western Bliss Gardens on December 5, 1952. It began each day at 8 in the morning and continued until 9 in the evening. Although the ascent up the mountain to the temple was long and hard, the gathering numbered around 100, as large a group as the temple could comfortably hold. Participating in a Buddha recitation session is an excellent method for eradicating heavy karmic offenses and alleviating the massive suffering which has resulted from accumulated bad habits. At the time, a growing number of inauspicious astronomical occurrences, the appearances of comets, shooting stars, rings around the moon, eclipses of the sun and moon, and the like, as well as an increasing number of human disasters, both natural and man-made, prompted the master to find ways to use the united effort of many devoted Buddhists in order to pull beings out of their sufferings. Intent upon eradicating bad karma on a worldwide scale, those who participated in the session were particularly concentrated in their mindfulness of the Buddha of limitless light and life. On the evening of the fifth day, at the end of the sixth hour of recitation, a ghost suddenly took possession of Upasika Zhang Guoyu and caused her to become confused and incoherent. She had sense enough to go before the master, kneel down, and beseech him to transmit the five precepts to her. So deep was her determination to get rid of the ghost that for several days she continued to kneel and reiterate her plea to the master. Eventually he consented, and only then did Upasika Zhang begin to emerge from her semi-consciousness, stupor, and return to a clear waking state. Those who participated in the session witnessed the unusual changes which this woman underwent in the course of those few days. The miraculous responses which touched the lives of people during the master's years in Hong Kong are themselves uncountable, and even farther beyond reckoning are the hidden cases of disasters that were avoided, calamities that were averted, and illnesses that simply failed to develop or were miraculously cured. Many people who received the Master's compassionate aid have wished to relate the details of their experiences so that others can come to know of the boundless healing power of the Buddhas of the Ten Directions, and can realize that anyone who is sincere can tap that compassionate source. Upasaka Li Guoyuan, a member of the Hong Kong police force, had a young daughter, Tia Yen, who one day carelessly slipped and fell. Several days after the accident, the child began to run a high fever and complained of severe pain in her leg. Her mother and father thought her symptoms were due to the complications resulting from her fall and sent her for treatment to a famous herbalist, Li Zubei, who specialized in the treatment of broken bones. After Dr. Li examined her, he told her parents that their daughter's illness was not a result of the fall, but was due to an ulcerous infection in her leg. Following his diagnosis, the girl was taken to many doctors, but none could help her. Like most Chinese at that time, her parents did not believe in operations of Western medicine, especially for a child of 3 or 4. They considered her too young to be cut up. Finally, someone suggested to Upasaka Guoyuan's wife that they take the child to Western Bliss Gardens to see the master. His wife took the advice, but when she arrived at the temple and expressed her request, the master replied curtly, "I don't dispense prescriptions." Mrs. Li returned home but couldn't abandon the hope that the master could help her daughter. So she went back a second time. Again, the master flatly refused. The third time, Upasaka Guoyuan accompanied his wife to Western Bliss Gardens, and the couple knelt before the master, imploring him to cure their daughter. After assuring himself of the sincerity of the husband's and wife's request, the master agreed to seek the aid of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Within a week, Tia Yen's ulcer had disappeared, and her leg had returned to normal. All 5 members of the Li household were so moved by this miraculous healing that they took refuge with the Triple Jewel and bowed to the master as their teacher. He instructed them to recite the Buddha's name. While the master has made a thorough investigation of all 5 schools of Buddhism and has mastered the skill of Chan, he never fails to instruct his disciples in the Pure Land doctrine of recitation of the name of Amitabha Buddha so that they may gain rebirth in the Western land of ultimate bliss. This Dharma door, which simply entails sincere and single-minded recitation of the 6-syllable vast name, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha Buddha, is suitable for those with abundant good roots, for those with average good roots, and for those with a few good roots. It can be used by the intelligent and the dull-witted alike, and can effect responses during one's present life. After death, it also can lead to rebirth in the Pure Land. There is no more simple or more direct method of cultivation. Tang Guoshan, who had long been the master's disciple, had true faith in the Buddha. One day she came to Western Bliss Gardens, and after bowing to the master, began to tell him some sad news. Her husband, Le Gang Nio, was suffering from third-stage tuberculosis, which at that time was considered incurable. Many doctors examined the difficult case, but each pronounced it too advanced for recovery. When the master heard this, he spoke some words of encouragement to his disciple and quieted her grief. Then he instructed her to convince her husband to diligently recite the name of Amitabha Buddha. If his life source was not yet exhausted, then by borrowing the strength of the Buddha, he could perhaps be cured. if his death was inevitable, then sincere recitation, although brief, could lead to his rebirth in the Pure Land. The master also told Guo Shan to explain to her husband that it is difficult to trust the workings of the heavens, and life itself is impermanent. When Le Ganyo heard his wife's report, he recognized the wisdom of the master's instruction and sought to become a disciple. On the third evening after he had taken refuge with the master, he had a dream in which the master appeared, wearing a magnificent crown of the kind worn by Earth's Door Bodhisattva, and splendidly garbed in a great red robe. A host of awesome bodhisattvas followed behind the master as he spoke, saying, "Your sickness is now cured. Don't worry anymore." In addition to the advanced tuberculosis, the layman had an obstruction in his intestines. But because the tuberculosis alone caused his family such deep concern, he had hidden the other illness from them. Even his wife didn't know of it. That night, the layman awoke, had diarrhea, and passed the entire stagnant mass of blood out of his system. Needless to say, the experience served to deepen his faith in the practice of reciting the Buddha's name. He redoubled his efforts so that at all times, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, he would not let go of his recitation beads, but continually said the name of the Buddha thousands upon tens of thousands of times. Such sincerity evoked a further response, and after a few months, his body became strong and healthy. Eventually, the physician's x-rays showed that the severe tuberculosis had disappeared. Xia Guoman continued to experience the miraculous power of the master's virtue. For 6 years after she took refuge with the master, she maintained the practice of abstaining from all food and drinking only cold water for 2 days out of every month, the 1st and 15th of the lunar calendar. Once, on the 1st, she planned to go to Western Bliss Gardens, but her son, Guo Xin, dissuaded her, saying that it was too far to go without having eaten. He convinced her that the hike up the mountain would be too difficult, so Guoman returned home to climb the 6 flights of stairs to the family's apartment. The building had no elevator. As soon as she entered the building on the 1st floor, however, she found herself suddenly on the 6th floor, outside her door, without having climbed a single step. Having been thus miraculously aided in her 6-story climb, Guoman was ashamed she had not had faith enough to realize she would be aided on her climb to the temple should she need it, and she went immediately to Western Bliss Gardens to pay her respects and bow in repentance to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Once, Guoman's daughter-in-law developed third-stage tuberculosis. Although Guoman's son and wife were both Protestants, the son asked his mother to help them by seeking the aid of the Buddhas. Guoman did so and received a prophecy which said, "Although the tree has gone bad, it can bring forth flowers again." Guoman beseeched the master to aid her family, and the master instructed her to renew her efforts in being mindful of the Buddha. After a time, her daughter-in-law got well, and subsequently had 3 healthy children. To this day, she remains healthy and prosperous and believes in the Buddhas. On one occasion, Guoman became ill with a strange karmically rooted disorder. No matter with whom she came in contact, she developed a headache and felt a nagging fear. Consequently, she grew reluctant to meet anyone. Wherever she went, she would steal away to a corner and sit where no one could look at her. The disorder also caused her to be easily upset, and she often felt on the verge of exploding into spells of anger. Worst of all, she was afraid of the master to the extent that she did not dare to look at him. The illness made her extremely uncomfortable, and she saw many doctors, but none could help her. Finally, she ventured to approach the master in spite of her fear. "I have always had great faith in you," she said. "Why am I so afraid of you now? This sickness of mine cannot be cured by Chinese or Western doctors. What am I going to do?"
"Wait a while," replied the master gently. "It's not quite time yet. After a while, you will get better."
Finally, although she was seriously ill, Guoman again went to see the master. He spoke with her and then told her to bow to the Buddhas. After about half an hour, he rubbed her head. Guoman stood up and found the disease had disappeared.
"You're better now," said the master. "You can go."
A few days later, her mind became unsettled again, and she felt ill at ease. She went to see the master again, and he freed her from the demonic obstruction. Since that time, she has never again been seriously ill, although she had been prey to a multitude of different diseases earlier in her life. What had the master seen that enabled him to know the appropriate time to cure Guoman of her disorder? He saw that she was being followed by a yellow wolf who wished to become a disciple of the master, but that the opportunities were not yet ripe to receive the wolf. Since Guoman had drawn near to the master, the wolf had attached itself to her in order to draw near to him as well. When the conditions ripened, the wolf was received as a disciple, and Guoman was relieved of the uncomfortable effects which its presence had caused her. One day the master received a letter from Dharma Master Qin Jiao, who resided at Jiulu Retreat, Diamond Hill, Kowloon. It said, "One spring I, Qin Jiao, bought a house in Diamond Hill, Kowloon. After I had lived there for a little more than a year, the landlord forced me to demolish the house and return the land. Having met with such an unforeseen and major loss, I fell prey to a mounting feeling of distress, which I could not shake off. One night at 11 o'clock, I was reading the Shastra on contemplation of the middle way, the chapter on the four truths, which says, 'I say that dharmas which arise from causes and conditions are all empty. They are false names. This, then, is the principle of the middle way. There is not one dharma which does not come from a conflict of conditions. Therefore, of all the dharmas which exist, there are none which is not empty.' Reflecting on this, I became absorbed in thought and repeated those words over and over to myself, trying to resolve my uneasiness and overcome my attachment. Eventually, without realizing it, I fell asleep. In a dream, I found myself walking in a mountain forest. As I was lingering there, a storm suddenly arose and I was caught in a downpour of rain. The claps of thunder were deafening. In the midst of my agitation, I caught sight of a Sangha member, soaring toward me from afar. His body emitted a purple-golden light. The wind and rain immediately ceased, and,
Thinking the apparition was a bodhisattva, I lowered my head and bowed. Drawing nearer, I recognized clearly that it was the elder Dharma Master Dulin, who had acted as a certifying master when I received the complete precepts. "Don't be afraid," said the master. "I am here. I will alleviate your distress." Soon afterwards, I found land and built a house. When the Venerable Master heard of this, he was at that time lecturing the Earth Store Bodhisattva Sutra at Jurlian, Jingyuan. He generously gave me $1,000 to help finance the completion of the construction of Jinglu Retreat on Diamond Hill. I am sending this account of my experience in the hope that it can be included in the biography of the Venerable Master, so that others may come to know of his miraculous compassion. Gan Guoyen, whose husband, Tan Guopu, had been granted a 12-year extension of his life, as related earlier, experienced many other miraculous events after becoming a disciple of the Venerable Master. At one time, her son became dangerously ill, and his condition rapidly became grave. He continually spit out mouthfuls of blood and had great difficulty breathing. Late one night, the illness reached a critical stage, and Guoyen telephoned the master, expressing her deep concern for her son's life. "All right," replied the master. "Everything will be all right." Within moments after she hung up the telephone, her son's violent vomiting of blood ceased, and before long, he fully recovered. Gan Guoyen also had a young grandniece who had developed sores on her head about 100 days after her birth. The stench from the pus and blood caused people who came near her to hold their noses rudely and begrudge the girl her very existence. In the heat of summer, the stench from the head sores were unbearable. Her hair fell out, leaving an unsightly bald spot. After Chinese and Western doctors had given up attempting to cure her, the family turned to experimenting with home remedies, but to no avail. When the child was 3 years old, her father died, and her mother went to work as a servant in order to raise the child. Every month she spent almost all her wages trying to find a cure for her daughter. The hopelessness of the situation frequently led the mother to weep bitterly. In 1954, when the girl, Xue Mei, was 10 years old, she had the good fortune to meet the Venerable Master and to take refuge with the Triple Jewel, bowing to the Master as teacher. After that, the ulcers on her head began to heal, and by the summer, the sores were gone and their hair had grown back, so that the girl had a chance to lead a normal life. In the early 1950s, Hong Kong experienced a severe drought, which seriously depleted the city's water supply. When there was no longer sufficient water in the city, people who lived near Western Bliss Gardens took to climbing the barren mountain to where the miraculous spring continued to bubble forth a sweet and pure supply of water. However, once people began climbing the fence and trampling through the gardens to fight over the water supply, the spring soon diminished to just a trickle, and the water was no longer fresh. When the master saw that Western Bliss Gardens' water supply was thus threatened, he laid down an ultimatum to his disciple Liu Guojuan. "You should recite the Buddha's name and seek for rain. In fact, if it doesn't rain within 3 days, you needn't bother to come back and see me." The master's instructions threw Guojuan into a panic.
She could do without a lot of things, but she could not bear the thought of never being able to see her teacher again. So she took up her beads and began reciting with such intensity that she was totally oblivious to everything around her. For 6 months, Hong Kong had been without rain, and all the Buddhist temples in Hong Kong had been engaged in one kind of ceremony or another, designed to bring rain to the drought-stricken island, but without success. Since the master doesn't interfere with mundane matters, he paid no attention to the problem for some months, until it became so critical that people were stealing Western Bliss Garden's water supply. After that, once he gave Guo Juan the ultimatum, it rained. In fact, it wasn't necessary for him to wait 3 days once he decided that the rain was needed. It could have rained immediately. Why? Because it is dragons who oversee the rain, and he had received 10 dragons as disciples in Manchuria. Their retinue of subsequent converts were obedient to his bidding as well. However, the master also saw that conditions were ripe for his disciple Guo Juan to accrue some merit by single-mindedly reciting the Buddha's name, so he gave her 3 days of work. Once the rain set in, all the various Buddhist associations throughout the city put ads in the newspaper saying, "The rain has come as a response to the efficacy of our ceremonies." Western Bliss Gardens was the only association which did not advertise its merit. Liu Guojuan, who was over 80 at the time, had become a disciple of the Buddha at 60. When she began to study with the master, she was totally deaf. Nonetheless, every time the master lectured on the sutras, she came to attend. Even if she could have heard, she could not have understood the words since he lectured in Mandarin, which she did not know. Every evening, however, despite her age, she would make the long climb up the mountain to be at the lecture at 7 sharp, and after it was over, around 9 o'clock, she would go alone back down the unlighted mountain path. She was so sincere and faithful in her attendance that one evening she suddenly heard the words, "Namo Lanchur Hai Wei Fo Pusa." Namo Lotus Pool Assembly of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, as vast as the sea. And with that, she regained her hearing. This miracle caused her to be even more sincere. Every time the master lectured sutras, no matter what sutra it was, she came to listen, and she redoubled her efforts in cultivation. It is often the case that when people sincerely cultivate, demonic obstructions arise. When people become intent upon studying the Dharma, former offenses catch up with them fast, and their progress is hindered as a result. Those who wish to become Buddhas must undergo the tests of demons. One night, Guo Juan had what seemed like a dream, yet was not a dream. In it, 3 plump children about the size of 2 or 3 year old toddlers appeared. They were very fat. After that apparition, Guo Juan fell ill. The symptom was a ravenous appetite which caused her to be obsessed with food, and she ate from morning to night. She required a full meal every 2 hours or so, and in a single day she ate at least 10 times. She thought she had something physically wrong with her and went to several doctors, but when they examined her, they all said that they couldn't find the source of her problem. She endured 2 years of this until one day a strange event impelled her to speak to the master. She climbed the mountain to Western Bliss Gardens
As soon as she saw the master, she blurted out, "Shifu, how could there be someone in my stomach who can talk?"
"What did they say?" the master asked calmly.
"This morning I used some coarse rice flour to make a cake, and when I ate a piece, someone in my stomach said, 'I don't like to eat that stuff.'"
"What did you reply?" asked the master.
"I said, 'If you don't eat that, what are you going to eat? Just pipe down and make the best of it.'"
She had carried on this conversation with her stomach.
"Don't worry," said the master. "Tonight you will be cured. If the child is old enough to talk, it should get born. When you return home this evening, you should go before the Buddha in your home at midnight and light a stick of incense. Then recite the Buddha's name."
She returned home and did as the master had instructed. While she recited, she saw three plump children emerge from her stomach, the very plump children she had seen in her vision 2 years before. As they emerged from her stomach, she saw Waito Bodhisattva take them by the ear with a good pinch and lead them away. Then, for the first time in years, the laywoman felt that her stomach was empty, really empty, and after that, her obsession with food was gone.
Who were the three fat children, and why did they invade her stomach?
When the master looked more deeply into the matter and contemplated her particular causes and conditions, he found that in a former life in which she had also believed in the Buddha, she had been acquainted with a person who had experienced the same kind of sickness. After the sickness had passed, the acquaintance told the laywoman about it, but she had scoffed in disbelief. "Whoever heard of hungry ghosts getting into one's belly and then carrying on a conversation?" Since she doubted it in a past life, she got to experience the disease firsthand in this life and had to endure 2 years of being inhabited by hungry ghosts. In her case, they were three weird creatures, two frogs and a lizard, which manifested themselves as three plump children. During her sicknesses, there were a lot of people in Hong Kong who didn't believe there really were creatures that lived in her stomach and talked to her. They said, "Whoever heard of such a thing?" It remains to be seen in the future if they will also experience the strange malady for themselves. The workings of karma are extremely complex and not at all arbitrary. Not only does the master's healing power know no bounds, but his wisdom is unfathomable and his eloquence unobstructed. One day, layman John Sui Chong, accompanied by a friend, Dr. Zhou, came to Western Bliss Gardens to pay a visit to the master. Dr. Zhou was a physician who specialized in fractures and was skilled at setting broken bones. Since the master speaks in accord with the needs of his hearers, he said on that occasion, "A severed bone can be healed, but how can one continue when life has been cut off?" The doctor answered, "One cannot continue when one's life is cut off."
"No?"
"In the past, in the period of the Three Kingdoms, Guan Yu was poisoned when an arrow pierced his arm, and his life would not have lasted more than a day and night had Hua To not scraped his bones and healed him. His life continued. Is that not continuing when one's life has been cut off?"
"Of course, that method of continuing life was not actually an ultimate one. The method I teach for continuing life depends on understanding the mind and seeing the nature, and ultimately, upon becoming released from birth and death. It is designed to enable one to leave the sea of suffering, transcend the vicious cycle of rebirth, and return to one's original nature. Understanding the mind and seeing the nature depends upon true investigation, and obtaining that certification is like that of a hen sitting on her eggs, or like that of a cat stalking a mouse. It is ceaseless attention to the mind until suddenly, at the right moment, one becomes enlightened. That is certification to the unproduced. Investigating Chan is not the same as reciting the Buddha's name. It is necessary to probe deeply into the meaning of the Chan topic, the Hua To. It is a thorough, intense, ultimate search during which one presses on until the mountains disintegrate and the seas dry up, and one can see the bright flowers beyond the dark willows. After mounting to the top of a 100-foot pole, one takes one more step. In just such extreme circumstances, one can suddenly obtain a new life. Birth and death are then in one's own hands, and King Yama no longer reigns supreme. This is the method for the continuation of life. In this very generation there is the Venerable Master Xuyin, who has lived more than 100 years, and is still alive in the world today because he has perfected the method for the continuation of life. The two laymen were immeasurably pleased with the Master's instruction, and returned often after that to visit Western Bliss Gardens and draw near to the Venerable One. Zixing Chan Monastery. Hong Kong is a British colony, and a significant percentage of its population is Christian. For a long time, there were only two large Buddhist monasteries on the island, Dong Pu To and Bao Lian Monastery on Dayu Mountain. In 1953, as the turmoil on the mainland increased, Sangha members in great numbers began to leave their native provinces to immigrate to Hong Kong. Upon arriving in the city, they found that there was no room in the monasteries or nunneries to house them. Unable to secure suitable places to live and to carry on their study and practice, they took what they could get, and as a result, their practice and meditation were neglected, and their samadhi powers dispersed. Their years of long, hard, earnest cultivation were on the verge of coming to an end. The preservation of the Triple Jewel, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, is the foremost concern of the Master. For a long time, he had realized that it was absolutely essential to do something about the severe shortage of monastic buildings in Hong Kong. But he had not had sufficient resources to resolve the problem, beyond establishing Western Bliss Gardens Temple. Western Bliss Gardens was small and already filled to capacity. In the autumn of 1953, a warm-hearted Buddhist layman named Dong Guoji generously contributed a 2-story villa as an offering to the Buddha. The villa was located on Wanzhangbu on Dayu Mountain, Lantau Island, far from the city, in a deep valley ringed by mountain ranges. The path to the site is steep and rugged, and people rarely ventured into the area. The Master was delighted to obtain the villa, especially because it was near the ruins of Guojing Chan Cottage, a way place which had been burned by the invading Japanese army during the war. The resident abbot had been killed. Only remnants of the devastated structure remained intact. The piles of rubble and broken tiles made the grounds unsightly. The trustees of Guoqingchan Cottage gave the abbot permission to make use of both the villa and the cottage to form a monastic complex. Since the master did not have sufficient resources to undertake the entire project right away, a plan was drawn up, and repairs were begun on the villa. It was transformed into a Buddha hall and comprises the left wing of Zixingchan Monastery. When the renovation began, the master was in the midst of his Sharangama Sutra lecture series at Western Bliss Gardens. Nevertheless, he rose every day at 2 a.m. in the morning, packed up whatever supplies were needed for the day, and took the early ferry to Lantau Island. By the time the sun lit up the peaks of the surrounding ranges, the master was at the bottom of the mountain, and he began the long ascent on foot to the monastery site. It was not unusual for him to carry 100 pounds of supplies on his rugged climb. Sometimes, if necessary, he would make yet another trip back into Hong Kong on the same morning and would repeat the difficult climb bearing additional supplies. Then began a long day's work of supervising the construction, advising, planning, lending moral support, and as often as not, adding his own labor to the task at hand. As soon as the initial arrangements regarding the transfer and use of the land and buildings were settled, the monastery began receiving members of the Sangha as residents. Some aided the work of renovating, cleaning, and maintaining the grounds, but some were more interested in eating and sleeping. So it turned out that many of the supplies that the master, who took only one meal a day, carried up the mountain during those months, were foodstuffs for the lazy and greedy monks. The master never complained about their incessant requests for more supplies, however, but quietly complied with their wishes. In the late afternoon, the master would go back down the mountain to catch the ferry to Hong Kong. Even then, he did not rest, but delighted his fellow passengers by giving informal Dharma talks during the 45-minute crossing. His unobstructed eloquence, combined with his ability to adapt his presentation to the nature of each individual, was as captivating as his manner was unassuming. With no effort on his part, he managed to attract an ever-increasing gathering on those ferry boat rides, who listened as the master made good use of the time by expounding the Dharma for them. Arriving in Hong Kong, he would climb the mountain to Western Bliss Gardens and deliver a formal lecture on the Sharangama Sutra. He retired at 11 for 3 hours of rest before repeating the same strenuous round of activities the next day. The master continued this schedule day in and day out, week in and week out for several months. After he finished lecturing the Sharangama Sutra, he began lectures on the Earth Store Sutra, and gradually his hair turned snow white under the stress. He did not let up, but continued the rigorous schedule until construction of the Zixing Monastery was finished. After the work was complete, he relaxed his schedule somewhat, and his hair grew back black as before. During that period of construction, Upasaka Zhang Hui gave the following description of the renovation of Zixing Monastery. The Buddha Dharma does not thrive by means of asking and granting personal favors. It is only on the strength of vast, deep vows that one is able to obtain the aid of the Venerable Master Dulun, the Superior One, founder of Zixingchan Monastery. He provides an excellent example. In the spring of 1951, After the Venerable Master built Western Bliss Gardens Buddha Hall on top of Ma Mountain in Shangqiwan, Hong Kong, he made a vow to establish a Bodhi Mandal which could house a large gathering of Sangha members working and cultivating together. The power of this vow was as great as the Buddha Dharma is inconceivable. And today, after 6 years, Tsuxing Monastery, a Bodhi Mandal of grand monastic scale, is finally complete. Located on Linghui Mountain in Wanzhongbu on Lantau Island, the monastery includes Guoqingchan Cottage and the two-story villa of the elder Upasaka Deng Guoqi. When the fiery waves of the Battle of the Pacific reached Lantau Island, Guoqingchan Cottage was burned by the Japanese troops. As a result, the Sangha's dwelling was destroyed, and amidst the remains, only the framework, which was half buried under the rubble of tiles and gravel, remained. There was no door, no windows, and no roof. Nothing except four stud walls which were crumbling and shaky, mottled with lichen, and full of holes. Weeds choked the cracks in the walls and covered the jagged tops. Upasaka Deng's villa, although the better of the two structures, had been abandoned for so long that it too was missing its windows and doors, and the only thing that made it better than Guoqingchan Cottage was that its roof was still intact. As it was ruined to such an extent that it was like a wasteland, how did the Venerable Master go about renovating it? In the autumn of 1953, Upasaka Deng Guoqi took refuge beneath the seat of the Venerable Master and made the great and generous vow to offer his villa. Not long after, having also secured permission from the guardians of Guoqingchan Cottage, he gave the remains of the cottage to the Venerable Master. Although Wanzhongbu, Linghu Mountain, is a distant place in a remote valley where there are few people, the master was pleased to receive the holy place as it tallied with his vow to establish a monastery. He considered it an ideal place for meditation and cultivation of the way. Repairs were completed on the villa and the guest hall early in the spring of 1954. That same year, on May 18th, Jinti Bodhisattva's birthday, the ceremony for the installation of the image of the three sages of the Western Land was held. That marked the completion of the left wing of Tsuxing Monastery. The Great Hall is now undergoing repairs, and July 18th, the anniversary of Guanyin Bodhisattva's birth, has already been set aside for the ceremonies to install the images of the Tathagatas. During the renovation of Tsuxingchan Monastery, the Superior One, the Venerable Master, dispensed with sleep and forgot to eat. He rose early and traveled in the darkness before dawn, even when buffeted by winds and drenched by rains. The selection of workmen, the preparations of materials, the commissioning of images, the laying in of provisions, not one bit of the work did not spring from his efforts. Although there was a reliable group of faithful men and women who resolved to help, had it not been for the Venerable Master's constant resolve and powerful vows, the present Tsuxingchan Monastery, strong and complete as it now stands, a Bodhi Mandal of vast and awesome monastic proportions, would have remained an unrealized hope. As to the present-day Tsuxingchan Monastery, there is a great hall, the left wing, and the guest hall, and in addition a dining hall, a room for practicing in seclusion, and a cabin. To the left is the dragon-subduing rock, and to the right is the tiger-taming stream. The architecture is superb, with white walls and red pillars framed by the surrounding mountains. It truly can be said to borrow the efficacious atmosphere of heaven and earth, surpassing all other natural settings. It is certainly not inferior in grandeur to the famous four great mountains and eight small mountains on the mainland. It is in all respects comparable to the appearance of Nan Hua, the Bodhimanda of the sixth patriarch. During the rebuilding of the Bodhimanda, an incident occurred involving jealousy. We all know that when a new Bodhimanda is established, it is bound to provoke the demon kings. During 1953, when the Bodhimanda was under construction, a red-headed, green-body poisonous snake kept appearing at the way place. When the Sangha members first saw it, they caught it in a barrel and took it several miles beyond the grounds. But before the party had returned, the creature had already reappeared on the monastery grounds, crawling along in plain sight. It was removed again, only to reappear again. Time and again, the same thing happened. Once, the snake was taken particularly far away, but when the lid of the barrel was lifted to release it, it was nowhere to be seen. Thinking this strange, the man who had taken the barrel away replaced the cover with a light tap, and suddenly, the severed body of half a snake fell out. By the time the man had returned, however, the body had become whole once again, and the poisonous snake was seen crawling in front of the Buddha hall, where it coiled itself, lifted its head, and darted out its tongue. Snakes belong to the class of dragons, and when the Venerable Master was in Manchuria, 10 dragons took refuge beneath his seat. Therefore, the Venerable Master proceeded to shape a golden dragon on top of the dragon-subduing rock, to the left and behind the left wing of the monastery. He fashioned it with teeth bared and claws brandished in such a way that it appeared to be on the verge of flight. After the golden dragon was complete, the poisonous snake was taken away and it never reappeared. Virtue can subdue demons. Sincerity always provokes a response. The poisonous snake that formerly bothered the way place has not come back. Just in this way can demons turn into Dharma protectors. The tiger-taming stream is a mountain torrent several miles long. It flows to the right and in front of the monastery, and every rainy season the flash floods on the mountain presented countless problems for travelers. Because of the difficulty, at the place where the stream passed through and under the road which lies within the Lingshan Bodhimanda Memorial Arch, halfway down the mountain from Cixing Monastery, the master constructed a bow-shaped stone bridge, and beneath the bridge hollowed out a pool, making a pool for liberating life. After that, the mountain waters had easy passage down, and not only did the stream no longer obstruct travelers, but with the pool, it became a place for the benefit of aquatic creatures. From these various incidents, one can see that the renovator of Cixing Chan Monastery does not work by happenstance, and that through long experience he is certainly able to cause the great ones of the Dharma doors to come forth in profusion. Hence, all those who desire to work hard cultivating the way will certainly gather around him like clouds from all directions, and their accomplishments in the future will definitely make a brilliant page in the history of Buddhism. Fearing that the virtuous ones of the four directions might not yet have given attention to the great new Bodhimanda, which has been established, I have written this article as a respectful introduction to it. In the spring of 1954, the left wing of Tsuxing Monastery was completed, and the installation of the three holy ones of the western direction, along with opening ceremonies, were planned for March 16th, the birthday of Junti Bodhisattva. Beginning on March 13th, the Great Compassion Repentance was bowed for 3 days, and a ceremony for relieving the suffering of hungry ghosts was planned for the evening of the 15th. The transition period between spring and summer was marked by endless rain and mountain fog, which made the entire landscape appear to be covered with a huge piece of white silk. People couldn't see 10 feet before them. On March 14th and 15th, the same wretched weather prevailed, and all those caught up in worldly considerations feared the great ceremony set for the 15th would certainly have to be canceled since it was scheduled to be held outdoors. The master told the laywomen who had volunteered to make the meal offering to prepare food for 1,000 people. They protested, saying that because of the rain, no one would come. The master scolded them for their lack of faith and again told them to prepare for at least 1,000 guests. Meanwhile, the rain continued and the roads and paths got muddier and muddier. Then, in the late afternoon of the 15th, the master said, "It would be best if the rain were to stop so the path could dry before the ceremony. Tomorrow, it would be best if there were light clouds so the day won't be too hot for those who climb the mountain." Shortly thereafter, to everyone's delight, the rain ceased and a light breeze prevailed. By early evening, the paths were firm and passable, and the ceremony was conducted as planned in the fresh air. As the 16th dawned, a light cloud cover let the sunlight through enough to warm the land, and a light breeze kept the atmosphere fresh and cool. Such an ideal day brought streams of visitors to the opening. From Lantau Island, Castle Peak, Zunhuang, Hong Kong, and Kowloon. Over 1,000 people of all classes gathered at the monastery where they were served a vegetarian meal. Bowing to the Buddhas began at 10, and following lunch, the ceremony for opening the light on the images was held at noon. The Buddha hall was so packed that all one could see was bobbing heads, and outside people gathered at the windows blocking the light. According to the reports from the residents of Lantau, the celebration of the inauguration of the left wing of Tsuxing Monastery brought more spectators than any celebration held there for several decades. The following account was related by Upasika Tan Guoshu, who witnessed the incident.